Schönen guten Morgen, meine Damen und Herren. Erstmal vielen, vielen Dank an der Konrad-Adenauer-Stiftung, dass ich hier sein dürfte. Es ist eine große Ehre, hier ans Podium zu stehen. Ich fange an einfach mit einer Entschuldigung. Ich hätte meine ganze Vortrag auf Deutsch machen könnte, aber ich finde immer noch, dass ich auf Deutsch nicht sagen kann, was ich sagen will. So I'll switch to English. And I'll begin today by telling you that a story about one of my former bosses who told me the sign of a good speech about the internet is no one takes out their smartphone while you're talking. So I'll try to be that entertaining over the course of the next half an hour. I'll begin today by telling you a little bit about myself. I find myself in Berlin because I married a German 12 years ago, and that was the best decision that I ever made. And I have enjoyed my time in Berlin so far and expect to continue to enjoy it. I started my career here in the United States Capitol. I went as a young PhD to Washington to learn about politics, and learn about politics I did. I was a legislative aide to a congressman working on the early debates about internet policy in Washington, and that was the formative time in my thinking about technology and policy. Then I moved on from Capitol Hill, and I started a consumer protection organization called Free Press. And the idea was that Washington was making all of the decisions that would shape the future of the internet, and most internet users had no idea. And so we started an organization to bring people into the legislative and regulatory process to understand how they could play a part in shaping the future of the internet. That effort went very well, and I was invited after 6 years to become an advisor on an electoral campaign for a young senator from the state of Illinois. That turned out to be another good decision. And we wrote for Barack Obama the most detailed and progressive technology policy agenda of any presidential candidate in history. And he has stuck to that and put those issues on his priority list for the last 6 years. But all of us at that time, all of us involved in the campaign, went into the administration in various ways. And I was fortunate enough to work with this fine lady. This is my favorite picture of one of our finest diplomats and greatest political leaders, Hillary Clinton. And my task at the State Department was to help design a digital strategy for American foreign policy. A challenging task at the time of WikiLeaks and the Arab Spring, but nonetheless a critical moment for us to realize the power of the internet. Now, I have come to Berlin and joined the leadership of the Stiftung Neue Verantwortung, a startup think tank seeking to make a difference in German policymaking and in European policymaking. My focus is again on internet policy, how the future of the internet will be shaped by policy decisions, and how technology intersects with every aspect of social and economic life, as Dr. Puttering pointed out in his introduction. Now, throughout these years, I've dealt with very similar challenges. What is the impact of the internet? And when I was at the State Department, one of our senior diplomats, an older gentleman with a pinstripe suit and a white shirt and a red tie, listened to my presentation and leaned across the table and he said, "This reminds me of the 1950s. And I said, "Excuse me, sir?" And he said, "Well, a young man sat across from me just as you do now in the 1950s telling me that television would change everything." And it changed some things, but it didn't change everything. He said, "Tell me why the internet is any different than any other change we have experienced in the 20th century of media revolutions, whether it was the newspaper or radio or television or satellite. And I said, I'll get back to you. But I went away and I thought very hard about that question, and I have since come up with an answer which I think is instructive both for my own work and I hope for yours. And what I call it the triple paradigm shift. So if you think about why is the internet different than any other information revolution in history, it is this reason. Modern societies sit on top of three information systems. The information system of commerce, the information system of the mass media, and the information system of personal communications. Now, think of that historically. The information system of commerce historically was the same network that moved goods from buyers to sellers. It began with the shipping lanes and then shifted to the railroads and then in the 20th century to the highways and ultimately to the skyways. But now the information systems that move information between buyers and sellers is on the internet. Similarly, we can think about mass media, which moved from mass circulation newspapers to radio to broadcast television to cable and satellite, and now increasingly mass media is also delivered over the internet. And we can think about personal communications, starting with the postal service and the telegraph and the telephone, and now the internet. So what this shows us is that the three major information systems of modern societies that have historically been separate are now converged. This causes a great deal of disruption in society, it causes a great deal of disruption in markets, and it causes incredible challenges for policymakers because policymakers are used to dealing with these information systems as separate. They are no longer. This is the center of the thinking behind why the internet is different and why we are at a historical moment. But what does this mean in practical terms? What does it mean that our three information systems are converged onto the same network? To me, it means we now live in a society of networked information that stretches across all three domains. What do I mean by that? Think about Facebook, whether you're on Facebook or not. Think about Facebook. Is Facebook a marketplace for moving products and services? Yes. Is Facebook a delivery system for mass media? Yes. Is Facebook a platform for personal communications? Yes. And I've done all of this, and I have just looked at the screen of my smartphone. Every interaction that we have with this information network, this converged information network, pulls data from those three systems and leaves a record, a digital footprint that can be captured and stored and analyzed and reused in ways that we may never know. These are the disruptive elements of the triple paradigm shift, the conversion of three information systems in modern societies. And the power unleashed by this convergence is enormous. And ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake, the debate about digitalization is about power. It is a competition for access to information and information technologies, and it is a competition over control over these resources and the opportunities they bring, both within nation states and among nation states. And like all tools of power, network technologies produce both good and bad outcomes, and it is the job of policymakers to take on the endless and difficult task of maximizing the good outcomes and minimizing the bad outcomes while having no ability to predict the next development in technology. This is why we have been talking about digitalization for the entirety of my professional career, and we'll continue to talk about it, likely for the rest of it. Now, this is the job of policymakers. In Europe, that job is called the Digital Agenda for Europe. In Germany, we have very creatively called it the Digital Agenda for Deutschland. Sometimes we break these umbrella terms into smaller slogans. Sometimes we call it Industry 4.0, and sometimes we call it Netzpolitik, and sometimes we have fancier terms like platform capitalism. We're talking about the same issues. We're talking about the impact of converged information systems on society and economics. These are the basic challenges that drive the political economy of digitalization. And in both Brussels and in Berlin, all the major issues and important problems of the digital agenda are known. They are on the planning lists. They are in discussion. And they should be known. We've been talking about them for years. We have experienced a policy debate about digital that is long on rhetoric and short on action. What do I mean by that? Well, Europe continues to lag behind the world leaders in technology markets. This is a problem that has been discussed in Brussels for 10 years. Europe's digital infrastructure remains underdeveloped. Europe has few major players in digital content and service markets to compete with the American super brands or with the rising Chinese giants. Europe lags behind all of its peers in investment in new technology startups. Europe lacks a strong entrepreneurial culture to foster and sustain innovation. And Europe's regulatory frameworks are outdated and require modernization. And yet, with these challenges, these issues don't seem to register with European voters. They are not priorities, as much as we would like them to be. That is why the rhetoric recycles. It recycles because to solve these problems require difficult decisions, and difficult decisions are not made on issues that are not priorities. So why aren't they priorities? If the stakes are so high, why are we accomplishing so little? And what can be done? In my humble opinion, the answer starts with two things. First, communications, and second, bold decision-making. First, communications. Both private sector and public sector leaders need to do a better job of explaining to people what the internet is all about and why it matters. Let me give you an example of what I mean, because you may think, well, we all sort of know what the internet is about. I have it in my pocket. It's all over the place. Digital, can't open a newspaper without reading about digital. But let me give you this simple test. I can ask my 8-year-old, how does the newspaper get to my mailbox in the morning? She can more or less tell me. Somewhere, somebody has a lot of paper and they're stamping ink on it. And then somebody else puts it in a truck and drives it to the house. Similarly, I ask her, how does the radio work? She can more or less tell me. Somewhere, someone is speaking into a microphone and they are using a big plastic dish to broadcast it over the air. And I turn on my radio and I receive that signal and I listen. Virtually everybody in our society can explain those technologies, whether they're 8-year-old or 80. But ask yourself, how many PhDs in this room can explain how a YouTube video appears on your smartphone? I see two hands out of a 200. What that shows you is a fundamental disconnect between the technologies that are running our lives and our knowledge about how they work. That disconnect is a part of the problem about why these issues aren't priorities. We cannot prioritize what we fail to understand. Education is the first step towards political support for change. And once you have educated people to a critical mass of interest, you must act boldly. Bold leadership and digital agenda are two phrases that have not gone together in Europe. But the challenges of digital are not complicated. That's a bit paradoxical to say. This is not rocket science what needs to be done. The inflection points, the most difficult problems of solving digital policymaking are known. I think about them as three basic things. One is investment in infrastructure. The entire digital marketplace, whether we're talking about Facebook and Google, or we're talking about factories of the future, or we're talking about smart classrooms, sits on top of an information network, a physical asset that we must build. Second, we need rules of the road about data. Data privacy and security are critical topics in a world where everything we do is digitized, recorded, stored, and analyzed. And finally, we need to create a culture of innovation. We need to foster entrepreneurship to build the businesses of the future and to reach the creative ideas which will transform societies in positive ways. And in the rest of my speech, I'm going to talk about these three things. I could talk for days about this. You're going to be talking all day long about elements of these issues in the sessions that follow. I'm going to highlight just a couple of issues under each of these points. So first, we'll start with infrastructure. This is the area where we have almost no disagreement. No matter who you ask, everybody agrees we need to improve our infrastructure. We need a world-class information network in Europe. This is our key, our baseline, our threshold for global competition. Building a future-proof infrastructure is easier said than done because it's all about spending money. That is a more difficult topic in European politics. It's about spending both private sector and public sector capital. And what we've learned in the last 10 years is that the private capital markets won't invest in a 25-year project that doesn't give them quarterly returns. They won't do it. What do you do about that problem? This is the core of the political debate, and it will take vision and it will take tenacity to insist on long-term investments that do not reward market actors in the short term. What are the alternatives? And what do we know about them? Well, let me tell you, folks, the path of least resistance is to say, let's not spend public dollars or public euros. Let's hold on to our money. Let's just see what the private sector can do by itself. Let's hope that if we trade away competition and regulation, that we will get incremental investment in our infrastructure and it will be just good enough to give us what we need. That is the current wisdom in Brussels right now. You need look only as far as the United States to see what happens if you do this. We did this. We took this approach. We traded away competition policy. We traded away regulatory oversight, and we hoped for the best from private capital markets to deliver a world-class infrastructure, and it failed. The latest analysis from the American Telecom Regulatory Agency, the Federal Communications Commission, points out that most Americans that live in cities and want fast internet service have one choice, a monopoly cable modem service provider. If you do not live in a city, tough luck for you. Your choice is a copper wire. And while engineers in telephone companies have done amazing things to squeeze bandwidth out of copper wire networks, they are just about good enough to meet the demand of today's internet user. They will not be good enough tomorrow. So now what? Well, I won't speculate on what American politics is capable of right now to solve that problem, but I will say in Europe, we should learn the lessons of American failures in this respect. If you want a fiber optic future-proof information network in Germany and in Europe, that is a smart move. And if you want to retain the benefits of the competitive market and internet access services that you have had up to now, that's even smarter. But you're going to have to make a plan to get what you want and not settle for what you can get. That's the distinction. It's going to require substantial capital from both public and private sector, and it will not always be popular budgetary policy. But the brief history of the internet economy teaches us, history of the internet teaches us that the market eventually rewards the bold. Bold leadership in infrastructure is critical. Now, I'll say a couple of words about the net neutrality debate. I spent many years of my life working on it. I feel like I'm watching the same movie over and over again. If you decide on a solution that is super fast fiber optic networks, one of your side benefits is you don't have to talk about net neutrality ever again. Because it won't matter. Because the net neutrality debate is about putting a price tag on access to networks that don't have enough capacity to serve all of its customers. If you have lots of capacity, you don't have a problem. And here's another side benefit. I hear a lot of talk in Europe about we need a European Google, we need a European Facebook. Where are our technology giants to compete and to become the most valuable company on the planet? And indeed, that is a noble goal. But that logic informs in the net neutrality debate a false perspective. And that perspective is, well, if we don't have enough capacity in our networks to serve all of our customers, at least we can charge those jokers from America extra money to get access to our network, and then we can take money from Silicon Valley and put it into our infrastructure. It's very appealing. Unfortunately, your trade rules will require that if you're going to charge access to your networks, you're going to have to charge everyone. And guess who has the money to pay any price you ask? Those very same Silicon Valley companies that you're worried about. So if you move to a system of pay-for-play internet, you are locking in the monopolies of the companies you want to knock down. This is a very serious problem that is rarely mentioned in the net neutrality debate. And if you're skeptical about this argument, take a look at the net neutrality debate happening in Washington. Barack Obama is pushing for very strong net neutrality rules. They will likely be made in the end of February. Apple and Google and Microsoft and Amazon have not lifted a finger to help him do that. Why? It is not an oversight, it is a strategy. And it is a strategy whose lessons we should learn in Europe. But let me move on, and I'll move to the question of data, another big topic in European technology policy circles, another thankless task for policymakers. The data debate is about reconciling the conflicting interests between, on the one hand, unfettered innovation that uses data in ways that we might not like, and on the other hand, consumer protection against unfettered innovation. How do we balance these interests? Let me highlight briefly what I see as the two major problems in data policy. One is privacy and the other is security. They are related, but for now I'm going to separate them, and I'm going to separate them again and say let's take privacy and security and let's separate them into private sector data privacy issues and public sector data privacy issues and private sector security issues and public sector security issues. And I will give you a shorthand, and I will call the first problem the Google problem, and I will call the second problem the NSA problem. Because what we're really talking about here is the application of power in the digital world. Who has power over my data in the marketplace? And who has power over my data when it comes to state institutions? Those are the fundamental questions of privacy and security that policymakers must solve. And in both cases, there is a fundamental disagreement between Europe and the United States. And in that transatlantic negotiation, Europe feels like it is not getting the good side of that bargain. And Europe is right. Why is that? What's going on here? Here's one way to think about it. I think the basic problem here is that a different understanding of the regulatory approach to data policy. The American approach is to say, well, we're not really sure what the market is going to do. We're not sure what the outcome is going to be. And with the NSA, we don't know exactly what they do with their $50 billion, and let's just see how they go. They're responsible people, and they're doing important work. And if and when we see a problem, we will respond to it. And we will respond to it based on our principles And our principles are all about democracy, and our principles include privacy as a core value. But it's ex post regulation. We will respond to problems after they appear. The European approach is to say, privacy is a fundamental right, and therefore we are not permitted to wait for bad things to happen. We must regulate preemptively. We must create a set of rules that anticipate all possible problems, as far as we can tell. The Americans can't handle that approach, and the Europe can't handle the US approach, and therefore we have a stalemate. I'll give you one symbolic representation of that, which is the German term for this, informationelle Selbstbestimmung. This word does not exist in English. This concept is not understood by any English-speaking country. My recommendation, short and sweet, is that Europe is going to have to accommodate itself in some way to the American perspective on the Google problem. I don't mean to say abandon data protection, far from it. I mean smart data protection. I mean think about ways to level the competitive playing field with strong oversight, effective enforcement, and a persistent revision of the rules to redress harms. You can take an ex post model of regulatory control over data protection and you can raise it up to a high level and you can achieve a good result. That is an interesting path forward that has not been fully entertained. On the NSA problem, I think the reverse. I think on the NSA problem, the United States needs to move towards Europe. On the NSA problem, we need desperately to develop a legal framework that supports legitimate surveillance in law enforcement and intelligence. The events in Paris in the last weeks have taught us that digital surveillance is not optional in modern society and security policy, but it must be done properly. And it must be done in a way that the average citizen on the street believes that it is appropriate, necessary, and proportional use of force. This is the issue that I have spent the most time on in my 2 years at the Stiftung Neue Verantwortung, developing the framework for a legitimate modernization of privacy and security policy. I think it's one of the critical issues of our time. But let me end on a happier note, and this is all about innovation. To build an innovative society, we have to move towards cultural change. We have to persuade our young people that entrepreneur is not a hobby, but a profession. Too few people believe they can change the world with their ideas. How do you change that? Difficult problem. A recent survey from the Vodafone Institute pointed out that too few young people in Germany are interested in becoming entrepreneurs in technology companies. Germany ranks lowest among 9 European countries when it comes to interest of under 30s in becoming entrepreneurs. We need to fix that. And here are two ideas for sparking innovation. One is we need to understand that the state has only a small role in creating an innovation society and driving technology markets, but it's an important role. But it's a small role. There is nothing that government can do to get investors to put money into bad companies. And there is no amount of deregulation that can stop investors from putting money into good companies. But there are things we can do to facilitate, catalyze new markets. One is we can help build ecosystems. And I'll give you an example here in Berlin, the Factory, which many of you may know. It is an innovation hub, a startup center in Berlin Mitte. The investors took a building through a real estate deal facilitated by local government, and they turned it into an innovation center. It has super fast internet, it has high-tech tools, and it co-locates a critical mass of talented people who all believe in entrepreneurship. Much more could be done to build ecosystems like this. We could look at linking them with publicly funded research institutes, of which Germany has some of the world's finest. We could think about streamlining work visas for foreign talent. We could think about reducing the time and difficulty of starting a business and folding a business in this economy. And we could think about those super fast fiber optic networks applied at the local level to support an innovative ecosystem. And last but not least, I think government can play its own role using its own institutions by working on open data. If you take my argument that data is an asset, an economic asset in the 21st century, government holds one of the most impressive and valuable stores of data assets of any institution in society. And yet, most government data is not available to the public. And Germany, in particular, is way behind its peers in opening up data for innovative uses. Now, some data is personal and some data is sensitive, and that should absolutely be guarded and held in restricted ways as it is today. But the vast majority of data that government has is not sensitive and is not personal and has high value in the market that no civil servant can possibly predict. So why not make it public? And in this sense, Germany's slow start on open data could be perceived as an advantage. When your absolute value is zero, any change looks like progress. And as Peter Thiel tells us, the greatest innovation comes when something appears where nothing was before, and we go from zero to one. So I will end my talk by telling you this begins with political education, and it ends with bold leadership. And that education begins in places like this, and with people like you. These are the rooms and these are the forums where we begin to teach one another why these issues matter, where we organize ourselves behind our priorities, and ultimately push our political leadership to act. Thank you very much, and I look forward to the day.